It was exactly this day, 2 years ago, on August 26th, that someone chose to stay seated on the sidelines at the beginning of a certain preseason game between the San Francisco 49ers and the Green Bay Packers. After a brutal summer enduring the reports of a string of black young men shot and killed by police officers across the country, Colin Kaepernick had had enough. His arms and legs and body and spirit just couldn't do it anymore. He just couldn't stand at attention. Keep the churning in his stomach and the knot in his throat subdued long enough to ring out "or the land of the free and the home of the brave" anymore. After the game, as you can imagine, reporters asked him for a statement, and Kaepernick offered pretty clear response, though it's been picked apart by many. "I'm not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color. To me, this is bigger than football, and it would be selfish on my part to look the other way. There are bodies in the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder." There he was, standing before the shrine erected to state power, proclaiming a truth that had really been ringing out for centuries now. Exactly 2 years later, and these kneeling protests have made their way, if you will, to the throne room of the emperor. And they seem to have aroused his fury and vitriol. A man who chose peaceful public protest has been called a son of a you-know-what by the President of the United States of America. The same president who can proclaim that if he shot someone on the street, the public would still choose him. Seems to me like Kaepernick's protest must be getting at something then. He sought and acquired the audience and attention of those with power to either maintain an injustice or to change that injustice. He used the power and platform he had, a citizenship granted to him not by birthright but by the 13th Amendment, to rouse the anger, to summon the hypocrisy, to expose the violence of a system that continued to diminish and demolish his inherent value. He brought to light an unsettling dynamic, that his bowing knee was somehow more disrespectful to the country than that country's grinding historic violence. He knows better than to think his access to this power and platform makes him better than anyone who doesn't have it, than the millions of young black boys who don't have it. But he's willing to expose his country's reality of violence by refusing the facade of peace. To the emperor he went. And it turns out that the emperor's new clothes look just like we thought they would, without a single stitch of integrity, empathy, or honesty. The Apostle Paul found himself at a similar press conference of sorts. Even though we only read a portion of Acts 25 today, the entire chapter, all the way through the end of Acts, paints a portrait of a Paul, stomach churning and throat knotting, who finds himself facing kings and generals and regional leaders, all asking him what he is up to and why he is so hell-bent on incessantly interrogating the workings of the empire. I invite you to read those chapters. They may seem boring at first, but I assure you they're not. Why is he so hell-bent on talking about this Jesus whose message of liberation for the poor and oppressed meant to set the captives free? And in this moment, which we read today, with one of those high and mighty leaders, in this case it's Festus, Paul finally has had it. He can't stand at attention anymore and continue with the charade. He can't hold his tongue or his stomach and sing Hail to the Chief or God Bless Romana. So he finally does it. He says he's had enough with these false accusations set against him. And much like the Hunchback of Notre Dame, he pulls out the bit of leverage, the bit of power and platform he has, and he cries out, Sanctuary! Paul reminds me of one of my favorite moments on The Office when Michael Scott realizes that he's in serious debt and Oscar, his accountant, explains that he's going to have to declare bankruptcy. So Michael walks outside his office, stands before his workmates. Wait, if you've seen this, he stands before his workmates in the front of the office and he cries out, I declare bankruptcy! And Oscar kind of has to walk him back and explain that that doesn't quite do it. Except when Paul does it this time, it actually works. He says with a sigh and a cry, I appeal to the emperor. Festus takes one look at him and with his own sigh and a cry says back, you have appealed to the emperor. To the emperor you will go. Paul uses the power and platform he has, not granted to him by the goodness of the Roman Empire, but through a series of brutal land acquisitions that gave some ancient Jews a certain level of passport power in the ancient world. He knows better than to think this power and platform makes him better than anyone else, makes him better than the thousands upon thousands of people living under the thumb of Caesar's rule, but he's willing to expose his country's reality of violence by refusing its facade of peace. Did you know that the Department of Defense for a number of years now has been funding patriotic displays during the national anthem at sporting events for what they call paid patriotism? In other words, their marketing people fairly easily figured out that sporting events, i.e. when people are feeling pie in the sky about the day, about their team, about their country, is a great opportunity to market the valor and power of the American military machine. That's why football players run out to the field before the anthem, something they didn't do years ago. That's why fighter jets zoom through the sky. That's why banners and colors and soldiers and fanfare invoke a certain aura as people hold their hot dogs in one hand and their hearts in the other. It's so fascinating to me that Americans are quick to ask the question, why does Kaepernick have to protest this way? And so incredibly slow to ask the question, why in God's name are we singing the national anthem and flying jets and throwing red, white, and blue parades at a football game? Perhaps we Christians haven't thought too critically about what our citizenship even means. Perhaps when we Christians hear the Holy Book tell us that our citizenship is in heaven, we think that that means we don't really have to reflect on our role as citizens of an earthly kingdom all that much, since none of it really matters anyway in the end. We're citizens of heaven. Why worry about the earth? And for those of us who happen to be born on this soil, we are automatically granted our citizenship while immigrants currently being blamed for everything from murder to the economy study to take tests about a country that most American-born people fail on their first try. Thank you for elucidating that point, Sarah. So what does it mean to be a citizen? What wall inside us and between us does citizenship have the danger of producing. And if I can press the point a little more, perhaps my deeper question is, what does it mean to be a citizen of a place and a Christian? We've been following along with Dr. Willie Jennings' commentary on Acts. He puts it far more profoundly and succinctly than my efforts can. He says, disciples of Jesus should be desperate citizens. Disciples of Jesus should be desperate citizens. The desperate citizen will press their citizenship as far as possible for the sake of thwarting death and its agents. Paul, as he moves through the political ecology of Rome, illumines this kind of citizenship. It is a citizenship that takes seriously the position of the most disadvantaged by empire. Those trapped in its prisons, found begging on its streets, those receiving the brunt of its unleashed violence, those made slaves to its economic machinations. For some of us, embracing the experience of a desperate citizen might look like putting all our access, all our privilege, all our passport power on the line for the sake of others. For some of us, being a desperate citizen might be running for office in a district that has no intention of ever granting their constituents equal rights or protections under the law of the land, much less the law of God. For some of us, being a desperate citizen might be simply living our lives in bodies that have been refused rights and dignities for centuries. For some of us, being a citizen in the same land we live in isn't even an option on the table. So our daily thriving is our act of citizenship. We have the unique opportunity as a deeply diverse community when it comes to our relationship to citizenship to think critically and collectively about that relationship. About how much power we let it have over our identities and self-worth. We get to push and pull on each other, if we're up for it, in unexpected ways, challenging our imaginations about how to use whatever access, power, platform we've been given in this life. Which means, stay with me, that the more we listen deeply to each other's context, to each other's relationship with this construct called citizenship, we will discover that our approach as a church cannot be absolute or one size fits all when it comes to, if you will, thwarting death and its agents. God calls us to this story in different ways at different times. For different reasons to do different things with what we've got. Paul could have stomped his foot, revoked his citizenship, and refused the rights afforded to him. But Paul knew full well that Peter and Stephen and the slave girl we talked about last week, they didn't have that choice. Paul knew full well that the platform and power he had could be used to shine a light back on the violence of the empire. He could be granted audience with the most violent of them all. Jennings puts it this way. The purpose of citizenship for a disciple of Jesus is to use the emperor's gold to break the emperor's hold. To use the emperor's gold to break the emperor's hold. This means using the capital. capital, the access, the connections, the power we have in service to God's kingdom in whatever way we see it's possible, where we are with what we are doing and touching and being and seeing and becoming. But it takes discipline. It takes deep relationship beyond our particular context. It takes committed listening and interrogation to get really clear about how and in what ways God's reign looks nothing like Caesar's. What does it mean for you? In your workplace, with your bank account, with your passport, with your body, with your story, to thwart death and its agents. What does it mean for you to consider your citizenship a desperate one? One that does not define you, one that you do not live in service to, but one that you utilize for the sake of God's good reign on the earth. Jennings goes on to say that while some work for the welfare of the empire, we work in empires for the welfare of God's creation. Try that one again. While some work for the welfare of the empire, we work in empires for the welfare of God's creation. This is the Christian life. This is a life after the way of Jesus, to work not for the welfare of the empire, but to work in empires for the welfare of God's creation. We have been trained from the cradle to give our lives and service to this country and all its machinations. As soon as your body entered this good earth, an entity you never asked to define you already started defining you, already labeled you, stamped you, constructed you, confined you, expected of you. But sometimes, you find your stomach churning and that knot forming, and you just can't sing a song about freedom until everybody's free. And you realize that rocket's red glare sounds a lot like a war you don't want. And the bombs bursting in air sounds a lot like bloodshed you want to stop. And that your citizenship, your birthright, your very self is in heaven. Not to cut you off or separate you or leave you disinterested and disengaged from life on this earth. Oh, the contraire. But to make sure you don't get it twisted. To make sure your priorities stay straight, to make sure you are always dreaming and scheming about how to thwart death and its agents. With or without whatever passport the gods of this world have or have not given you. Will we go to the emperor? Beloved church, will we use whatever power and platform we have to call out, tear down, rise above the walls that continue to wind through our land, scarring them with violence and greed? Will we accept that the Christian life, a life after Jesus, is one that works not for the welfare of empire, but within an empire for the welfare of God? Will we choose to create alternative spaces, perhaps with this very building on the corner of 8th and H, with our assets, with our time, with this church, with the church, Will we choose to learn enough about where death and its agents reside, even if we find out they reside within us? Will we put our hands on our hearts for the gospel of liberation? Will we ask God to help us sing a new song, one with the power to shake all the emperors of this world out of their boots, one with the vision to shift our wealth in reparative ways, one with a different melody, a different proclamation, a different imagination, a different story altogether? Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening skies. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Sing a song full of faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of hope that the present has brought us. Facing the rising sun of our new day begun, let us march on till victory is won. Dear friends, will you go to the emperor? Whatever that means for you, I don't know. But I get the sacred gift of being a pastor, which means I get to sit with you and listen about what that might mean for you. So here's my invitation for this week, and as we start pressing towards an end to this series, I'm asking you to reflect a little on your life, your witness, your commitments, your assets, your world, your universe, and ask, what are my walls? What are my commitments? What does it look like for me to go to the emperor? Go slow with yourself. Take deep breaths as you do. Understand that the whole point I'm trying to make is the story isn't the same for each of us. The work doesn't look the same for each of us. But the commitments go deep. The possibilities go wide, and the opportunities go far. So reflect this week. What would it mean for you to thwart death and all its agents with your one and only life? As we said before, that work is not done in isolation. If you try to do that by yourself, you will die. I mean that metaphorically. I also kind of mean it literally. Do the work with the community. If that can be us, know that you're welcome to this place as we stand together and sing.